and welcome to another episode of the Slongcast. I am your host, Kevin Slonka, and it is wonderful to have you here again with me. Now, I'd like to start off by talking about a concert that happened last week. So about 3.5-4 weeks ago, I get an email from my choir director from college, and she told me that the choir that I used to be in was running low on guys. There were only two of them there this semester. Now, it's a small group. The group never really gets above 15 people. But there were only two guys, and there were, seven women. So, as you can imagine, the guys were getting a little outnumbered there. It's not that they're not good. They sing well. But two against seven, it's hard to hear guys when there's only two of them and seven women. So, excuse me. So, my director emailed me and asked me if I would be willing to sing for this concert. So, of course, I said yes. Now, that left me with 3 weeks to learn an entire concert's worth of music, which you might think, not so bad. It was only, I don't know, between 10 and 15 pieces of music. However, the hard part, 90% of the music was in either Latin or Italian. Now, if you know me, you know that I like singing in not English. Basically, any language other than English. English sucks. It is the worst language to sing in ever. Nothing sounds good. So I like singing in languages like Latin or Italian. But the hard part of that is, not only did I have to learn how to pronounce everything in these songs, I had to learn it on my own, and I had to learn the music on my own. Luckily, I used to take piano lessons, so I'm able to pound out a few notes on the piano to figure out what I'm supposed to be singing. But that was actually pretty rough. You know, 3 weeks of trying to learn all this music by myself, no help from anybody, but got it done. The concert was last week, and it was great. I had a lot of fun, and I just wanted to publicly thank Nancy for asking me to come and sing again with Vox Nova up at Mount Aloysius College. A lot of fun, and afterwards, we went to Olive Garden, and we had a little Italian celebration dinner, I guess. Celebration, yeah. You know, all of our music was in Italian, so they figured, hey, let's go to Olive Garden. And they even made up their own words to the song Funicoli Funicola, talking about pizza, pasta, put it on my plate, blah, blah, blah. So they were singing that the whole time. Whatever. It was a blast. And I'll go to Olive Garden anytime. I don't need a reason for that. But anyways, I just wanted to say, you know, thank you again for inviting me to come back and sing. It was a lot of fun. And hopefully, in the coming semesters, you will have more guys try out. That bothers me. I don't know why more guys don't sing. I don't know why more guys don't get into choral performance and theater. It's a lot of fun. I mean, if you've ever sang in high school, or you know, even if you sing in your car and you're not bad, you know, you should give it a shot. I mean, I understand that if you play sports, you obviously can't be in a choir in college. Choir practices take up a lot of time. When I was in Vox Nova, we had practice every day. 3 days out of the week, it would be for an hour and a half. And Tuesday and Thursdays, it would be for an hour. And these were over lunchtime. But every day, we had practice. So if you were in sports and you had to be away for games, or because of being in sports, you had to schedule all of your classes for early in the morning or over lunch, you know, it's not possible. But if you have the chance and you're a guy and you like to sing, you should try out. I mean, have you seen the show Glee on TV? Great show. You can see that. I mean, I know I shouldn't be using Glee as an example because, come on, it's a TV show. Nothing's real in it. But even if you're a jock, you can still perform and sing. I mean, heck, when I was in high school, I did. I played baseball, basketball, and golf, but I was still in literally every choral group that I could be. You know, from the high school group to the men's group to the jazz choir, you know, everyone that I could be in, I was in. And it was a blast. I have a lot of fun singing. So I was talking to Nancy and, you know, maybe we're going to find some way to recruit people. I know when I started, or whenever I went to my first open house to check out Mount Aloysius, they had tables there with all of the clubs and all of the majors, and they had people there to talk to. And the choir, Vox Nova, that they were one of the tables. And they had people there that you could talk to about what it's like to be in Vox Nova and what you do. So maybe, you know, doing something like that again, I volunteered to go back and, you know, man the table for that one big open house a year, try to recruit some guys to come and sing, because it is a lot of fun. If you've ever heard a cappella music, you know, music where there's no instruments, just voices, and you've heard that big, full, rich sound whenever you have the basses singing the low notes and the tenors hitting the high notes and you got the sopranos and altos singing and all that comes together, it's a really cool sound. If you've never heard of these two groups, one of them is GLAD, G-L-A-D. The other one is Take Six. They are both a cappella groups, and you should definitely check out some of their work. The Take Six Christmas album is amazing. I mean, those guys, once you hear that, that will become your favorite Christmas album ever, guaranteed. And GLAD, I have almost every album that they've ever put out. You know, they're a Christian group, but they do so many things. They have Christmas albums. They did an album of all Gershwin music. They have, you know, Easter songs. They do so many different types of songs. And most of it, if not all of it, is a cappella. And it's just a great sound. So if you've never heard a cappella music before, or if you're, you know, wondering, oh, you know, I sang something a cappella in high school, it wasn't that good because we couldn't sing, you know, give a listen to GLAD or Take Six and you'll hear what real a cappella singers actually sound like. They are really good. So I like to change topics a little bit, moving into technology. A couple days ago, I saw an article that Kaspersky, big antivirus company, they released an antivirus client for Macintosh. I think I just heard a bunch of gasps out of all of you people listening. You know, that's one thing that most people don't associate with Macs, viruses. Macs don't get viruses. Well, you know, up until now, that's pretty much right. And why is that the case? Well, what operating system has the largest market share? Windows. Nowadays, viruses aren't out to destroy your computer like they were 10 years ago when they started coming out. Nowadays, people write viruses in order to make money. So sometimes you don't even know that you have a virus, but your machine has malicious code on it, and your machine is now part of some zombie network that these people are using to collect ad revenue, you know, to scheme some money out of people. But that's what viruses and Trojans and malware and everything is headed towards nowadays. The malicious people are using it as a way to make money. Now, if you're trying to make money, what are you going to go towards? You're going to go toward the operating system that most people are using, which in this case is Windows. So up until now, Macs and any other operating system have pretty much been forgotten, or I should say passed over, when it comes to viruses. But I'm sure you all have a television, and you've seen all of the recent Mac commercials, which, by the way, are hilarious and true. You know, they're not just out trying to make you laugh. There is truth behind every one of those commercials. But now that they're gaining market share, you know, even though it's only a percent, half a percent, a fraction of a percent, Macs are gaining market share. So that means that the people who write viruses are now going to be looking at them as a revenue flow. So because of that, Kaspersky thought, hey, you know, we should probably get an antivirus out there before the S hits the F, as to say. Now, you might be thinking, but I always heard that Macs were always more secure than Windows. Now, that's actually pretty much the case. I mean, let me explain that. Back whenever Windows XP was the main Windows that everybody used, that was pretty much the most vulnerable operating system ever. You know, whenever you log into the machine, you're an administrator on the machine. So you can do anything. You know, you can install programs, you can uninstall programs, you could modify the registry, you could delete files that you aren't supposed to delete and break your computer. You know, anybody who's logged into an XP machine can pretty much do whatever they want to it. So what did the virus writers do? Well, they used that. All they had to do was put something out on the internet, trick you into clicking on it, and all of a sudden, your computer became compromised. Either bad stuff happened to it, or you became part of a zombie network, you got a Trojan on there. Very easy to do. So, of course, all the virus writers were going to write viruses for XP, because all it took was, you know, one person to not be paying attention and click on something, and bam, they're infected. And I personally know probably hundreds of people that this has happened to. I cannot tell you how many computers I have had to clean viruses and spyware out of because people browsing the internet, they see, you know, those ads on the top of the screen. Oh, punch the monkey and you can win $1,000. And they click on the ad and all of a sudden now they're getting pop-ups all over the place and they got viruses. I mean, the general rule of thumb is people are stupid. And you put something pretty and flashy in front of their face and they're going to click on it. And virus writers, you know, use that to their advantage. With the addition of Vista and now Windows 7, they added what is called UAC, or user account control, or sorry, user access control. I don't know what it means. Basically, it's all of those extra pop-ups that you see anytime you try to do anything. It was really ridiculous in Vista. You couldn't do anything without getting 12 pop-ups. Are you sure you want to click on this? Yes. Are you sure you want to modify this file? Yes. Are you sure you want to save this modified file? Yes. Are you sure you want to close the program that you just saved this modified file from? Yes. I mean, you might think I was being a little overly ridiculous there, but I really wasn't. If you wanted to do something that modified a system file, you had 3 or 4 "Are you sure" pop-ups that you had to click on. Now, that is just plain annoying. Windows 7 does the same thing, but they kind of toned it down a little. So if you're modifying system files or files that might hurt things like programs installed on your computer, you're still going to get those pop-ups, just not as many of them. But here's the problem with that. They're still just pop-ups with a yes or no button. So just like virus writers took advantage of the stupid users who will click on anything bright and shiny you put in front of their face, they can still take advantage of the stupid users who don't read these pop-up dialogues and just click yes, yes, yes. Of course I want to do this. I wouldn't have clicked it if I didn't want to do this. Yes. Ask your friends. Ask your family. Anytime you get a pop-up, what do? You click yes. Do you ever read them? Nope. Nobody does. So as far as virus writers are concerned, they can still do the same thing. They can still write a virus, put something bright and shiny in front of your face, except now it's not going to automatically run when you click on it. Now you're going to get a little pop-up, are you sure? And of course, yes, you're sure. You're the one that clicked on something in your web browser. Whatever it does, you want to see it happen. So you're going to click yes, let it do whatever it needs to do. And just like in Windows XP, because you're an administrator, whatever you clicked on now has full access to your machine. So I will give Microsoft credit for trying to fix the problem. You know, they did add another layer that you have to go through in order to break stuff on your system, but it's not a working layer. It's just an annoying layer. And like I said, everybody just clicks yes. Doesn't matter what it says. It could be a bright red flashing it could tell you, you know, plain as day, do not click yes or your system is going to break. And nobody's even going to read it. They're just going to click yes. That's just how it works. We've been trained ever since the dawn of Windows 95 that when we get a pop-up box that starts off with the words, are you sure? Or even just the words, are you? We just click yes. We search around, and some of us even know where that yes button is. As soon as we start to get a pop-up drawn on the screen, we move our mouse to where that yes button is going to be, and then as soon as it's there, we click yes. Nobody reads that stuff. Now, Macs, on the other hand, they are a little different. You are still logged in as an administrator. Now, when I say an administrator, I mean an account that has control over most things, but you don't have control over the whole system. There's still another user level above what you are logged in as that has that ultimate control. Now, if somebody were to write a virus for a Mac and it needed access to, you know, something to break your system, to delete a file, you wouldn't get an Are You Sure pop-up, but you would get a box saying, please enter your administrative password. Now, that's not good. I mean, that's not the best way to do it. It is a step above the way Windows does it, because at least now you can see, oh, crap, you know, why is this thing asking for my administrative password? I just wanted to look at this website on the internet. You know, what does this need my password for? So I do think that's a step in the right direction compared to the way Windows does it with the yes-no box. But it's still not good because chances are if you clicked on something, you're going to do the same thing you would if you were a Windows user, and you're just going to enter in your password, hit OK, and then bam, whatever you clicked on now has access to your whole machine. So, you know, six in one, half dozen in the other. Neither operating system implements it perfectly. Linux, on the other hand, did it better for a long time. Before Linux has started to cater to the desktop user or cater to people they're trying to convert from Windows or Macs to Linux, you were logged in as a user with no rights. You were a plain user. You had no system level access. You couldn't install or uninstall anything. The only things you could do were work with the files that were in your home folder. You know, the files on your desktop, or if you downloaded anything. You couldn't modify system files. You couldn't, you know, connect to network drives or anything like that. So being logged in as this normal user meant that if you were to break something, you could only break your own login. Your system wouldn't die. You know, you wouldn't cause a crash or lose anything like that. Your system would always be running because you didn't have access to break anything. So the worst that could happen is you'd have to delete your user account and, you know, make a new user account for yourself to start fresh and log back in, and you're good to go. You know, that takes a whole 5 minutes to do instead of 4 hours of reinstalling your entire system. But recently, since Linux, all the different distributions of Linux are trying to cater to people switching, they've implemented the same thing that Mac is doing. So if you want to do something like install a piece of software or do something system level, you're going to get that password prompt. You know, please enter the root password. Now, like I said before, it is a step better than Windows because at least you can see, oh, this is asking for the password that has control to everything. Do I really want to put this in for what I'm doing? But again, most people will just type it because they're annoyed by it, and all of a sudden everything breaks. So as you can see, it's not at all impossible for viruses to be written for a Mac or, you know, any other non-Windows machine. So Kaspersky seems to be one of the first people to really put a product out there in front of people's faces. You know, there are other vendors out there who have had antivirus software for Macs for a long time now, but they're not as big of a name as Kaspersky. Most people, I would imagine, didn't even know that those products existed. And the ones who did were in the mindset of, I'm running a Mac, I'm not going to get a virus. Well, hopefully, the way that Kaspersky made this work, I don't know, I haven't downloaded it yet. I really should have did that before, you know, starting to talk to you about it so I had a better idea. But maybe next time I'll be able to give you a better idea of it. But I'm hoping that it also detects Windows viruses. Why? You know, why do we care? I run a Mac. If I download a Windows virus, I can do that all day. It's not going to run. It's not going to hurt my system because it's made for Windows. I don't care. But what if your friends run Windows? What if people you work with run Windows, or your family runs Windows, and you're sharing files with them? You know, maybe you're working on a paper for school, and you need to save it to a thumb drive and give it to a friend of yours to print out because he's going to be in the computer lab later in the day. Or maybe you put family pictures on a CD or on a thumb drive again, give it to your family. If you have a Windows virus on your Mac, you could inadvertently put it on that CD or on that thumb drive. You wouldn't know. You give it to your family or your friend, whatever computer they plug that into, now all of a sudden they've got the virus. So you have, in essence, transmitted that virus from wherever you got it from through your machine to somebody else's machine who is vulnerable. And now they have a virus, they're part of a zombie network, you know, their machine's being taken over, whatever. So I'm hoping that in addition to detecting malicious activity on a Mac and preventing any viruses written specifically for Macs, that the Kaspersky antivirus will also detect Windows viruses and warn you about those as well. I don't know that it does that. I mean, it wouldn't make sense for them to do it, because if they're making an antivirus product for a Mac, why would you want it to take care of Windows things also? But it would be really nice, because even though you are using a Mac, if you are, you can probably name 50 people that you know who use Windows. So hopefully Kaspersky is nice and is thinking about protecting everybody and not just the person on the Mac. So I thought that was pretty cool that a large antivirus vendor put out an antivirus specifically for Mac, the platform that nobody thought could get viruses. If you have a Mac, I think it's only $35 a year. Go download it. Seriously. You should not... Rule of thumb, if you are using any type of system that allows you to save data to it, that allows you to write to it, you should have an antivirus software, piece of software running on there. If there is any possibility of you saving a virus to that machine or downloading a virus somehow, either from a CD or from the internet, if there is any possibility of writing to that system, you need an antivirus. If not to protect you, to protect the other people on your network or on the internet that you converse with, share files with, whatever. So for only, whatever, $35 a year, it is definitely worth it. You should not run any system without an antivirus. I mean, even on Linux, there are tools like ClamAV and fprot, I believe. There are a bunch of tools that are antiviruses to detect malicious software on Linux as well. So if you have a computer, I don't care what it runs, if you have a computer, get some sort of antivirus software, some sort of firewall software. If you run a Mac, Macs come with IP tables. There's a nice GUI. It's already enabled. You don't have to do anything. So Macs already run a very decent firewall software. Linux has it also, and they have a kind of nice GUI to configure it, but that's running also, depending on your distribution. That should already be running. The Windows firewall, not so good. It's gotten better. If that's all you have, leave it running. If you have some sort of system like Blink from EI, EI security. I believe the Blink antivirus incorporates some sort of firewall. I know Norton and McAfee, you know, their suite of products has a firewall too. So if you have some other firewall product, maybe Zone Alarm also for your Windows machine, use that. Anything is better than the firewall that came with Windows. But if you don't, you know, don't turn off the Windows firewall because, oh, Kevin said it sucks. I did say it sucks, but it only sucks if you have some other product that is better. If the built-in Windows firewall is all you have, keep that running. Do not turn it off. And don't be one of those people who anytime you do anything and you get that pop-up, hey, the firewall detected that this is blocked, do you want to open it? You click yes. Don't be one of those people. That is just as bad as, you know, the are you sure boxes to give something you click on administrative rights to your machine. If you get any type of pop-up on any system, read what it says. If you don't remember what you did to cause that pop-up, click no or click cancel or close it. Don't enter your password. Don't click yes. Don't click allow. You know, if you're not sure what you did to make it ask for your password, cancel it. And then go back to what you were doing. And if it happens again, this time you'll know, oh, I clicked on this. It's asking me for my password because I want to install this. Okay, I'll put it in. No big deal. So hopefully, well, that was my security rant. I'll leave it at that. Another cool product that I just got an invitation to is Google Wave. I don't know if any of you have heard about Google Wave, but hopefully you've heard of, you know, Google Mail or Gmail, as most people call it. It's Google's email service. Hopefully you're using Gmail because it is way better than any other email out there. I don't know why people still use Hotmail and Yahoo Mail and whatever other kind of mail service is out there whenever Gmail is free and it is awesome. I mean, their spam filter is great. I can't tell you the last time I got a piece of spam in my inbox. And I have, what is it, three or four accounts being filtered into my Gmail inbox. Gmail allows you to get email from all of your email accounts in one place. So I get email from my Gmail address. I get email from a couple of my KevinSlonka.com email addresses. I get email from my Robert Morris student account. I get email from my Mount Aloysius faculty account. So I have a bunch of email addresses that all of those messages are coming into Gmail. And all of them get spam, especially my KevinSlonka.com addresses. Those are ridiculous, but I never see it. If I click on the spam filter, I can see it all in there, but Gmail detects it all and gets rid of it all. I can't tell you the last time I've seen a piece of spam in my inbox, so if you haven't been using Gmail, you should be. But the new product, Google Wave, is Google's new attempt at, I don't want to say their new attempt at email, because if you tell that to them, they will punch you and say Google Wave is not an email client, even though that's what I think it is. It's a new social communication client. It functions kind of in the same way email does, as in you send messages back and forth to people, but it also functions in the same way news groups do, in that you can have multiple people subscribe to that one thread and seeing and replying to everything in that thread. It also functions like a digital whiteboard. So all of those people could also, you know, bring up a whiteboard and draw out certain things if you're working on a design of something, or attach files to the thread, or, you know, put in sounds, or maybe put in a Google map into the thread if you're trying to tell people how to get to somewhere to have a business meeting or something. So it's really email plus Twitter plus chat rooms on steroids. It looks like they tried to take the best features of every communication client and put it all into one. Now, it's in very beta right now. you need to be invited, or sorry, you need to be nominated by a current Google Wave user just to get an invite. Sometimes the nominations are instant when you get an invite. Sometimes they take days, if not weeks. So if you are lucky enough to know somebody who has a Google Wave nomination, you know, don't get mad at them when you don't get your invite right away, because Google doesn't send them out, you know, automatically. I was lucky enough to follow somebody on Twitter who lives around the area, and I found out that he had some Google Wave nominations, and he nominated me, and I was one of the lucky ones to get my invitation within 5 minutes. So within 5 minutes of asking him to nominate me, I got my invitation. I was logged into Google Wave and using it. I'm not impressed so far. You know, I did the whole chat room thing, oh boy, you know, 10 years ago. That was great while it lasted. I really don't care to be in a place with a ton of strangers and talk to them in real time. You know, I don't want to talk to strangers. I'd rather talk to my friends and people I know. And a lot of the other features, I get along just fine with email. You know, I'm probably one of those people who isn't going to convert to Google Wave if it becomes this big thing right away, because everything I need to do, I can do with email. Everything I need to do, I can do with Twitter. You know, those are the two main things that I use, in addition to, you know, social networking like Facebook. But for those of you who know me, you know that my Twitter feed goes into my Facebook feed, so they say the same thing. But either way, you know, everything I need to do, I'm happy with the way I do it now. I tried to learn a little bit about Google Wave and use it. It's extremely slow. Now, it's brand new, and they're fixing it every day. They're making it better every day. But it is extremely slow. There were times I was typing in there, and I would have a whole sentence typed out, and then I would just sit there and watch as it caught up to me, one character at a time. Now, why is that the case? Well, it's very JavaScript heavy. They tried to do everything real time. So as you're typing in a thread, anybody else who is subscribed to that thread will see what you're typing one character at a time as you type it. You know, if any of you used ICQ as a chat client or a chat room client, instant messenger, or whatever you call it, back in the day, ICQ had this real-time chat feature. And a lot of other clients copied it, where you could see what they're typing, what the other person is typing as they're typing it. So that's what Google Wave does as well. And, you know, in an instant message, that wasn't so bad because it was a one-to-one connection. You were directly connected to that person. Their data went to your machine. Your data went to their machine. In this case, it's being done inside of a web browser. If you know anything about web browsers are not real-time things. They take data and they show data, period. That is all web browsers do. They are stateless. Once the data is on your screen, they remember nothing. So all of this extra JavaScript, all of this extra code had to be written so that every time you press a letter, it sends a data request back to Google servers, and then Google servers will figure out how many people are subscribed to this thread, you know, figure out who they are, and then send that character to all of those people. And then that would show up on their browser, on their screen. I mean, did you get the idea of how long and drawn out that sounds? That's what has to happen every time you do anything inside of Google Wave. Because it tries to be real time. It tries to show the other people that are on there with you what you're doing while you're doing it. In an instant message client like ICQ, like I said, not bad. One-to-one connection. Your data had to go one place only. There was no thinking. Whatever you did, bam, went to the other person. In a web browser environment, there are so many layers your data has to go through, so many other people trying to look at it. It just takes so much code. It bogs down your browser, very processor intensive. And the bandwidth that it uses is, you know, kind of minimal if it's just sending a single character at a time, but it has to wrap that character inside of HTTP packets, which make it bigger. And if you're typing out entire paragraphs, think of that, you know, one packet per paragraph, you're using up, you know, kilobytes, if not megabytes, depending on what you're sending, just to write a single thread in Google Wave. And then that's getting dispersed, you know, 12 times over if you have 12 people in your thread. And then if you have more people on your network using Google Wave, or, you know, on your in your town, if you're using cable internet, since cable internet is shared, if you have a bunch of people in one place using this, can you imagine the bandwidth? Every character that every person types, or every click they make, everything they do, being sent across the internet and then dispersed to all of the other people. I mean, that's crazy. So Google has a lot of work to do to make this be as fast as their other products, like Google Mail or Google Maps. I just recently tried Google Latitude. Haven't really gotten it to work, because the people who have accepted my location sharing requests haven't done it on their phone yet, so I don't see where they're at on the map. But I'm hoping a few more people that I send them to will accept them and start using Latitude on their phone, since that's what it's meant to be. And Google Latitude is pretty much a way to use Google Maps to show you where your friends are. Wherever your friends are, they open up Google Latitude, it reads the GPS coordinates from your phone, and places a pin on the map so that your friends can see where you're at. You know, kind of cool, kind of an invasion of privacy, but, you know, whatever. It's cool. It's out there. It's in, I don't know if it's in beta or if it's for real right now, but it's a cool idea. But it also runs fast. It's something they've had a while to work on. But Google Wave, you know, not so fast. So if you do get an invite, give it time. Maybe it'll, you know, they'll work it out. It'll be better. They'll add new features. So just don't get mad. Or if you do get mad, don't say, I'm never going to use this again. You know, Google hasn't made a bad product yet, with the exception of Google Video, but maybe they threw that away because they bought YouTube. Either way, Google hasn't made mostly any bad products yet. And that brings me to another service that Google has, Google Voice. Very cool service. So let me give you the rundown of the way Google Voice is supposed to work. So you sign up for Google Voice. You can pick a phone number, a real live phone number that anybody can call. You can pick a number in any area code. And if you want to take the time to cycle through all of the numbers to see what's available, you can actually pick the exact number you want, pending nobody else has it in the world. And the whole point is that you register all of your phones with the Google Voice internet or a Google Voice interface. So if you have a cell phone, if you have a home phone, if you have a work phone, I don't know, if you have any other phones, you register them all in the Google Voice interface. And instead of giving out your real number to people, you give them your Google Voice number. And what will happen when they call that Google Voice number, it will ring every one of your phones to try to find you. So let's say my Google Voice number is 555-5555. I give that to somebody, they call it. When they call that number, my cell phone is going to ring, my home phone is going to ring, my work phone is going to ring until I pick up one of them. So it's a really cool service, you know, twofold. One, people can get a hold of you if that's what you want. You know, chances are if you're using Google Voice, you want people to be able to get a hold of you, since that's what the service is for. So, you know, number one, it allows people to get a hold of you easier without thinking, oh crap, what's his work number? I forget it. Oh, I really wish I had his cell phone number. Now they don't have to worry. They call one number, and no matter where you're at, if you're around any of your phones, you will get the call. And it even lets you screen the call so you can hear who it is before you say, yes, I want this call, or no, send it to voicemail. And number two, it lets you hide your number. So, you know, maybe you are big into privacy. You don't want people to give out your cell phone number, but you do want to use your cell phone to take calls. You know, that's probably why you're paying that monthly contract, because you want to use it to make calls. But you wish there was some way that you could use your cell phone to receive calls from the people who you want to talk to, but you just don't want to give it out to everybody. So this is another way to allow you to make better use of your phones. You only give out your virtual Google number, and you can never have to give out your cell phone number or any other confidential number that you want. And you might think, well, what about the reverse? What about if I'm somewhere and I only have my cell phone and I want to call somebody, but I don't want them to see my cell phone number? You know, maybe you want to keep this whole charade going because this person who you're trying to call only has your Google Voice number. They only know that number is yours. They don't know you have any other numbers. What you can do is you can make calls through Google Voice so that whenever they see a call coming in on caller ID or whatever, it will show up as your Google Voice number. So you can still hide behind that virtual number. Now, you could always *67 when you call somebody, but that shows up as blocked. And a lot of people screen their calls and don't answer calls that show up as blocked. So calling through Google Voice is a good idea because people will still see that it's you. And you can also send text messages through Google Voice for free. That's right, you don't need a texting plan. As long as you can access the Google Voice interface somehow, either through your mobile web browser or a mobile Google Voice application, you can send text messages through the Google Voice interface to any number and you will not be charged. So that is really cool. I'm actually hoping that Apple approves the Google Voice application for the iPhone soon. You know, they rejected it. They won't say why, but I'm pretty sure they rejected it because of the fact that you can send those free text messages. And AT&T is making a lot of money on texting plans. I don't know which plan you have, but I'm paying $15. $15 a month on top of my cell phone bill for 1,500 texts. You know, I could go to the $20 plan for unlimited, but that's an extra $5 a month. You know, whatever 12 times 5 is, that's that much money a year. I'm not going to do math. I don't want to do math now. It's too late. But either way, they make a lot of money on texting. So as long as AT&T has a say, the Google Voice application will probably never get approved for the iPhone store. But if you really want it, jailbreak your phone, you can get it anyways. So up to you. But those are the two Google products that I wanted to talk about. Now, the last thing technology-wise that I wanted to talk about was in the area of web design. So for the past couple years, my website has been hosted with a company, and the servers are based in India. So, you know, not a problem. I'm not afraid of, you know, my data being stolen by people in India or anything, nothing like that. But one thing that I don't like is that whenever they do maintenance, you know, normal companies will do maintenance in the middle of the night, say, you know, midnight, 2 a.m., times whenever the utilization of their servers are at the lowest. Well, this company does the same thing, except that midnight or 2 a.m. in India is prime time in the United States. So my website will go down for an hour at a time in the middle of the day when I want people to be able to view my website and read the articles that I write. So I've been thinking of switching to something else, some other hosting provider. I've seen ads on all of the tech shows that I watch for Squarespace. And they made it look awesome. And the architecture of Squarespace is great. It's a virtual clustered interface, which if you go to kevinslonka.com, I did a write-up on Squarespace and why I'm not switching to them. And you can read all of this, you know, in more detail. But I'll tell you a little bit now. They use, you know, all virtual servers, and they're all clustered. So what does that mean? That means if a piece of hardware dies, your site's not going to go down. If the virtual server that your site is on dies, your site's not going to go down because it's going to fail over to another virtual server. If you write an article for your website or post something on your website that gets posted to Dig or Slashdot or some other site that is going to be bringing in millions of people at one time to look at that article, You know, normally web servers will go down because that is just, that's way too many people, way too much bandwidth load, and web servers can't take it. But because Squarespace uses, you know, a smart virtual clustering technology, if they detect your site is, you know, getting hammered, your site will be distributed across more virtual servers in the cluster, and your site will not go down. So you're pretty much guaranteed that your site will never go down ever, no matter what you do, no matter where your articles get posted, it will just never go down. So I really like that. And that was the main reason why I wanted to switch to Squarespace. But alas, I'm not going to be doing that, because in order to use Squarespace, you have to use their website editor. You can't design your own website, design your own graphics, design your own layout and put it up there. You can't control your own database. You know, I'm a coder. I write PHP. I know MySQL for the database. I like to do all of this on my own, write my own code, have control over my own website. You know, as minimalist and as sucky as it is, I like having control over the features that I have on there. I only have features that I need. I don't have anything extra. It does exactly what I want it to do. It serves up the articles that I write, nothing more. If I went with Squarespace, I couldn't do that. I'd have to use their editor, so my site would have to look, you know, based on one of their predefined templates. It just wasn't good for me. For somebody who likes to be creative and do things himself, Squarespace wasn't a good option. So if you're that type of person, Squarespace might sound like a great idea, but it's not. If you're everybody else in the world, who, you know, the people who don't want to write code, maybe you don't know how to write code, maybe you are a coder and you're just sick of writing code because that's what you do all day for your job, and you don't want to have to do that when you come home and you just want to upload something to your website. You know, for everybody else, use Squarespace. I mean, it's great. It is a little more expensive. They just upped their prices. So it's the cheapest plan that gives you your own domain name, so your own .com or .net or whatever, is $14 a month. So that's like $160, or maybe it's $15, whatever. It's like $160 a year. So that is about $40, you know, $30 to $40 more expensive a year than other hosting providers. But, you know, for that extra $30 to $40, the interface, it couldn't be easier. You know, if you're the person who likes to point and click and get things done, you will love the Squarespace interface. I don't like it because I'm not that type of person, but if you are, you know, use it. It's well worth the extra $30 to $40 a month. And if you have an iPhone, what's even better, they just released an application for the iPhone that you can totally manage your entire website from the phone, from the application. You don't have to go log into their website and do anything special. You open up the Squarespace application, you can post to your site. You know, when the new version comes out in a couple days, you can moderate comments. You can do everything to your site that you could if you were sitting in front of your laptop. So that is really cool. So like I said, if you're not, you know, a hardcore coder and you don't mind not having complete control over every little aspect of your website, Squarespace is great. And if you watch any Revision 3 shows, you'll know that you can find promo codes that will give you 10% off the lifetime of your order. So as long as you have a site with Squarespace, you will get 10% off whatever the cost of your, you know, monthly payment or yearly payment, however you do it. So that is a pretty decent deal if you don't want to have to write your own code. So that was everything technology-wise that I wanted to share with you. One thing before I go, I've never done this before, but I wanted to make a book recommendation. Now, for those of you who know me, you probably just gasped again. You know, wow, Kevin doesn't read. Why is he making a book recommendation? Well, the reason I bought this book was because it was for charity. The money, all the proceeds for the book go to helping cure cancer in children. So I bought the book and I said, you know, I'm going to sit down and read this. And the book is basically a diary, a mother's diary of, you know, all the days that she spent with her daughter as her daughter was dying of cancer. And everything they did, everything they were thinking. And her daughter would actually make these, you know, make these notes, these little postcards or papers, draw pictures, write messages, and hide them around the house for her parents to find. And all of, I don't know if all of them, most of them are in this book, so you can actually see them, in addition to, you know, what the mother wrote as time went on. So I just wanted to read two paragraphs out of the book to give you an idea of, you know, what these diary entries sound like. So I'm going to read day 64, which was January 31st. How do you measure time? When Elena asks how long she'll have to go to the doctor's or have her blood taken, I reply, a while. Is a while a couple of months? Or will it be for the rest of her life? And what if a couple of months are the rest of her life? A while doesn't mean the same thing it did yesterday. And I hope that one day, a while will mean a lifetime. As I walk through a day, I hear comments such as, I wish my children were older. I wish it were summer. Or, I wish this day would end. These offhand comments are how we relate to each other and how we grapple with time. But to me, I want it to just be today. As a matter of fact, I'd like it to be yesterday. Time has a way of sneaking up on you, even when you don't want it to. I only wish it would also slow down. So that was two paragraphs from the book from January 31st entry. And if you buy this book, you know, I can't guarantee that you will like it, but I can guarantee two things. One, your money is going to a great cause. And two, you cannot get through a single day's entry without crying. I will guarantee you that. So that being said, you know, buy the book. The book is Notes Left Behind. So if you, I believe the website is notesleftbehind.com. So look it up, you know, give it a buy. It's only, I don't know what it was, $15 or $25, whatever it is. It's not a lot. I mean, it's a good book. It's all, you know, diary entries of the parents and living the last couple months with their daughter. So give it a try. Money's going toward a good cause. And with that being said, that is it for this episode of the Slongcast. If you want to find out what I'm doing during my daily travels, follow me up on Twitter. My username on Twitter is Slongcack. It's my last name and first initial. Friend me up on Facebook. My website is kevinslonka.com. You can find any of the articles that I write, you know, tech-related, how-tos, or just random rants or cool things that I find. And I hope you all have a wonderful week.